WOWDLP Tacoma Park.
What a drag it is getting old. Kids are different today. I hear every mother say, mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day. Things are different today. Cooking fresh food for her husband's just a drag. So she buys an instant cake, and she finds a frozen steak, and goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper. And to help her on her way, get her through her busy day. Doctor, please, some more of these outside the door. Don't appreciate that you get tired. They're so hard to satisfy. You can tranquilize your man. So go running for the shelter of a mother's little helper. And for help you through the night, help to minimize your flight. Doctor, please, some more of these outside the door. Pursuit of happiness just seems a bore. And if you take more of those, you will get an overdose. No more running for the shelter of a mother's little helper. They just help you on your way through your busy dying day.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to your day in this hot and steamy D.C. metropolitan area. We hope we can get you juiced to talk about art as we do every other Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show.
Hi, you're tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park 94.3 on your FM station. The Artist Experience radio program has a unique mission. We look into the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners. Tom and I are trying to demystify art, making your art adventure richer and more enjoyable. Whenever you experience the visual, we try to bring to light art enfolding your experience into larger, brighter, more richly contoured surfaces, and transforming vague awareness into definite knowledge. We have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. And please look at it while you're listening. You can stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, SheilaBlake.com, and on ArtistExperience.com so that you can listen anytime, and the podcast can be found also on iTunes.
Well, we promised a third show on the maladies of artists, and we hope you can take another dose because we've had two doses before. But, Sheila, I've got to tell our listeners, I'm coming down with every disease we've been talking about with these artists. I'm like a pathological empathizer, and I'm also kind of have all these psychosomatic issues. So I hope I can get to the show because it's really taken its toll on with the research and all. You know, we're going to highlight some artists from a host of artistic periods that, unfortunately, died prematurely but left a great legacy in the arts. These artists made great art. They left a mark in the art world that still remains strongly. Artists have a lot to say about the world and what, and in the time they have to say it. But how much time do we have? No one really knows. We wanted to pay tribute in our last show on the maladies of artists and their legacies. Well, once again, let's talk a little about that legacy again, Sheila.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat what I've said before because I think it's important. An artistic legacy is the body of work an artist leaves behind that challenges the past, advances vision, opens new possibilities so that artists who come after can stand on their shoulders and see the landscape ahead. There are many good artists who make pretty, even beautiful work, and audiences are sometimes wowed by the techniques that can make the new look old. But a legacy that has the seeds for expansion, that even a century later, the discoveries are so fresh that artists in the future can scoop it up, absorb it, and add to the unknown and unseen. The artists we're discussing today, they are the giants of their times and perhaps of all times. No one could have done what they did, and their work is so distinctive that anyone who tries to imitate them will pale before them.
This program is about artists whose lives were cut short through a host of situations like disease processes, possibly addiction, and an artist's lifestyle that cut their lives short, and possibly the stigmas that led to their early demise.
We ended the last show talking about accidents and Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock died in 1956 when he was driving drunk and he plowed into a tree, killing his current girlfriend and her friend. He was 44. We all know about Jackson Pollock and his ascent to the art world post-World War II in New York City. As we discussed him and his wife, Lee Krasner, several times on the show, he keeps coming up. We have talked about as well as Pollock's bouts with alcoholism and his constant ups and downs. Pollock was not a good verbal communicator, and he had tremendous bouts of anger and rage, but his legacy is huge. We picked up the torch of innovation. He picked up the torch of innovation lit by Picasso. He eliminated deep perspective space, and he found how to create a huge cosmic space without true linear perspective. He allowed for the expression of chance operations. He showed that you could eliminate any kind of subject, and his pictures were big, up to 16 feet across. This created a different relation between the body and pictorial space. We could go on and on about his legacy, but we should do a full show on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's in due time.
Yeah, I think our listeners would like to know more about his art, don't you?
Well, you know, he's difficult to look at and he's difficult to interpret. And I think a lot of people are somewhat intimidated by the legacy of Jackson Pollock. Well, we've talked about Pollock before and his alcoholism. And there are many theories, but I wanted to interject on this, that he might have suffered from infant alcohol syndrome, as both his parents were alcoholics. And there's a possibility that he was actually kind of born with the disease.
Uh-huh.
And of course, he died at age 44 and left art in 1956. Well, the Abstract Expressionists of New York City, which Pollock was a group in that same group of the 1940s and 50s, were actually prone to alcohol drinking. Many of them, like Willem de Kooning, Franz Klein, Larry Rivers, Mark Rothko, and even my graduate preceptor, Grace Hardigan, all of these artists struggle with alcohol. And Grace Hardigan, who is a dear friend of mine, said she often told that she was only one drink away from death in her early 40s, but her husband saved her life, and she became dedicated to Alcoholics Anonymous, and she became drink-free, but always remind her students that she was always an alcoholic. And she's a success story, the late Grace Hardigan. And she knew all these artists very well. About that same time, we have a wonderful piece of writing that Sheila would like to share us about that whole epic.
I would. This is appeared in The New Yorker in 1946. It's by Arthur Kramer. Turner's, Duras, or Bellinis do not spring from dry martinis. Goya's genius, Rubens' powers, do not stem from whiskey sours. Fiume brandies, potent ciders, make no Holbeins, make no Riders. Alcohol's ingurgitation is, in short, no substitution for creative inspiration or artistic execution. Guzzle vino till you're blotto. Splotches will remain, but splotches, Perugino, Angra, Giotto. We're not born of double scotches, nor alas will full sobriety whisk you into their society.
Wow, that is so perfect for the abstract expressionists and that whole group, many of which their demise came through the bottle. A sad segue from the abstract expressionists is talking about the life of Achille Gorky, who is one of the early contributors to surrealism and abstract expressionism in America. And he's one of really my all-time favorite artists. He was born Vostanak Manugaduyan, or Gorky, when he came to America at the age of 16. As a young man, he witnessed the atrocities of genocide among the Armenians in Turkey in 1915. This is really a tough story. As an ethnic Armenian, his family fled from southeastern Turkey, like so many others did, to the ethnic Armenian capital of Yerevan. But then he witnessed the most profound event of his life, which haunted him his entire short life, and he watched his mother die of starvation. When I read about this, I get so choked up. He witnessed her dying of starvation in 1919. This event was the impetus to so much of his work in representational abstract painting. His identity was scarred so much that he changed his name from an Armenian name to Achille Gorky, which is a Georgian or Russian-sounding name. Well, he settled in Boston with a lot of Armenian immigrants, and he was very influenced by Cézanne and the qualities of proto-cubism and later Picasso. And he really kind of hit it quickly with gallery representation in New York. And he found much success in the late 1920s when he worked with the Works Progress Administration, like so many abstract expressionists did in New York. Well, he left New York City for Virginia, where he got married in 1941. And his career really solidified. And that was tough, being away from New York City, the center of art. But his career was taking off. But then in 1946, a series of events took their toll on him emotionally. His studio burned down. Now, I mean, that's an artist's ultimate nightmare. And then he had a bout with colon cancer. And then he was in a terrible, horrific automobile accident, which damaged his painting arm. Well, through all this period, his wife was showing signs of infidelity, and his wife and children left him, and he really kind of was down and out. And Achille Gorky hung himself in 1944, at the age of 44, and he was the forerunner of abstract expressionist movement with very much lyrical abstraction, and his work hangs in every major museum in the world, and he's really one of the great forerunners of abstraction, and a very sad story.
Yeah, well, we're going to take a little leap in time now, and I'm going to talk about something that happened to me. In 1974, I went with my then husband and kids across the country to see the earthworks of the 1970s. Now, these works are called land art, and maybe that sounds more like the environmental movement, but at the time, it was the biggest thing that an artist could think of to do. I mean, no more paint, no more brushes, earthworks. So let's get out and move some earth-moving equipment and move that mountain. or like Michael Heiser drawing the infinity symbol, riding his motorcycle on the Bonneville salt flats. We went to see Richard Serra's elevation piece in King City, Ontario. It was a long, long drive out into the cornfields. I've got a picture of my son Ben walking out on one of those concrete abutments. And it had some kind of system to it, this Richard Serra piece, but I didn't know. It didn't look like that. It just looked like these concrete pieces in a cornfield. And it was all lost on me and the farmer who had to combine around the concrete. And he was waiting for Abby Hoffman, who he mistook for Richard Serra, and the yippies to return and convene.
Oh, that's a good one.
I know. It was funny. So it was already hot, but nothing was compared to Michael Heiser's Double Negative, which is an earthworks piece in Nevada. We followed a guy in a pickup truck 17 miles through the desert, and in one of the vast mesas was a trench cut. You really could have missed it because the mesas are so vast and so they just surround you. And then there's this cut in one of them. So big deal. That's what I thought. And it just kind of seemed pitiful, except that the walls of the trench that he cut go way back in time, and there were shells from millions of years ago. So it seemed like to me like tiny man trying to tame or confront nature. It was hot. And then we went to see Robert Smithson's spiral jetty. Smithson had built a spiral out of volcanic rock that went into the Great Salt Lake. We could see the tracks of the trucks leading down to the water and then nothing, just water. So the level of the lake had risen and covered the work. Now with climate change, the lake has receded and it's beautiful, completely visible, and you can walk out on it. I read that Smithson accounted for the fact that it would be at times underwater, but I'm not so sure that he did account for that. I think it was nature. So Robert Smithson was an American artist, and he was born in Passaic, New Jersey, and lived mostly in Rutherford. William Carlos Williams was his pediatrician.
Wow.
Yeah, he was. Who knows what that put into him? Smithson was a visionary artist, a pioneer of land art. The spiral jetty was inspired in part when Smithson saw the Great Serpent Mount, a pre-Columbian Indian monument in southwestern Ohio. The earthworks were a radical departure from making formal objects situated in a gallery setting. Spiral jetty embodied one of his goals, which was to place work in the land rather than situated on the land. Smithson's earthworks defined an entirely original notion of landscape. Smithson did not limit himself to any one form or style of art. He used materials such as language, mirrors, maps, dump trucks, abandoned quarries, hotels, contractors, and earth to produce his radical sculptures, photographs, films, and earthworks. Smithson died in a plane crash in 1973 in Amarillo, Texas, while he was looking for sites for his future earthworks. The actual spiral jetty has been an under and out of the Great Salt Lake, and the white and pink salt deposits on the black volcanic rock are indeed a wonder.
Oh, yeah. Smithson really was a pioneer in that whole, you know, vision of using the earth as art and amazing, way ahead of his time. Well, we're going to go back a few centuries, and I like to talk about the mystery of Masaccio. Masaccio was born in Florence as Tommaso di Ser Giovanni di Simone. What a sexy name, huh? Go through life with that one. And Masaccio is really his nickname means you're a kind of a clumsy mess, which I think is the opposite of that. Anyway, but as a teenager, he was this rising star in the development of linear perspective and that true believable illusion that we all love when you look at a painting. It looks real. He was really one of the on the forefront of that. And he was credited to doing the first true linear perspective in the Trinity in 1427 at the Santa Maria Novella in Florence. He was only 26 years old, so he's really powering up the Renaissance in his early years. And he had quite a reputation for being a party animal. And he was known to live a life in the fast lane. Now that's the Renaissance fast lane, not 2018. But I have no idea how fast I could have been in the Renaissance, but he surely had an ego that was larger than the Sistine Chapel. Well, Masaccio, as a young man, could not paint fast enough. He had so many people wanting his work. And he also had a collaborator with him, the great artist Masolino, which means little Tom. And so they were a talented duo, and they worked on the Brancacci Chapel in Florence, which is a masterpiece of Florentine Renaissance. Well, they got a commission to go to Rome in 1428, and he and Masolino headed that way, and they started it. Well, very shortly after he arrived in Rome, he mysteriously died, and there was no record of how he died, but it was kind of odd because he was a very famous painter at the time. Why does a famous painter get this mystery? Well, the folklore is that he was poisoned And he's one of the few artists in the history of the world that were poisoned by a rival, and they don't know who that rival was. And other theories have come to light. There's one periodical that's called him the Kurt Cobain of Renaissance art. And it was a huge, he had such a huge input, much like Kurt Cobain, but he had the possibility of physical and mental burnout. He was so powered into art in the fast lane, and he just fizzled out. And there's other theories that he might have committed suicide, that he was so high on this kind of trip that he was on in the art world. But he is, as for the Renaissance and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that came before him, like after him, like Da Vinci and Michelangelo and Donatello and Raphael, his work was really the guiding light for the Renaissance. And speaking of fast lanes, like Masaccio, we have to talk about the baddest boy ever in art, and that's Caravaggio. We've talked about him in a previous program where there was a film about him. This guy was one bad guy. Anyway, Michelangelo Merisi, the Caravaggio, was born in Milan in 1571. He's after the Renaissance. And he died in 1610, very, very young. And he had such raw talent. He was comparable to Michelangelo and Da Vinci in the Mannerist period. He was innovative with his use of chiaroscuro, which is the use of lights and darks in a painting, and something called tenebrism, a very, very bright, bright color next to a very dark, dark color. Anyway, he was very influential in the Baroque period. But and he had influenced so many other people like Rembrandt and Peter Paul Rubens. But here's the deal. Caravaggio was a piece of work. I mean, wherever he went, he spelled trouble. I mean, whether he was like the bad, bad Leroy Brown of visual art. Okay, he was a barroom brawler, a tough guy. He had severe anger management issues. And he hung around with prostitutes, drunkards, and petty criminals all his life. And he used them in his paintings. And these were religious paintings, and I find that very ironic. They were all very, that's all he did was religious paintings for the most part, and some things out of antiquity. But he painted only about 46 paintings in his 38 years. That's a very small amount of paintings, and no drawings. That's another unusual thing. Although they think they recently found some drawings behind a wall in Italy, they just uncovered them very recently, that they might be of Caravaggio. They're not sure. But he was known to have these models like in a set of a theater set, and he would pose them and draw them as they were standing in these poses for long times. Well, anyway, in 1606, he killed Ranuncio Tomassoni under a host of mysterious circumstances at a tennis match. Imagine that, over a gambling debt. And it really kind of was about the Renaissance Italian honor code. Well, it was a duel. He won the duel, but he was clearly guilty. They had witnesses. And then he was on the run, and he became a fugitive. Well, he was looking for support from the powerful Italian families at the time, and I'm not talking about mafia families. I'm talking about the powers that be, like the Sforza family or the Colonna family, who were very powerful Milanese, the Sforza. But he couldn't get the kind of support that he needed, like, to get off on this murder. And so he ended up in Naples and in Malta. And, you know, the theme of this one is crime doesn't pay. He was on the loose, you know, no food, a fugitive, and he died of a fever on a beach in Grosseto in Tuscany. And, I mean, this is like one of the world's greatest Baroque painters, if not painters of all time, and he died in mystery. In 2010, they think they found his bones behind a church. And so they took his bones. He was a fugitive. He died on the beach, and they dragged him to this church, and then they buried him there. And the testing of the bones showed a huge levels of lead. Aha! Well, what does lead do? Lead does a lot to your personality when it's in the water and in the paint and so on and so forth. And they feel that might have contributed to his violent past and his very erratic behavior. Huge anger management. Mm. But his legacy endures. Although he was 38, He was one of the most influential artists in the history of paintings and religious art. And he also did something that was really not popular. He brought sex into the narrative of religious paintings. He made these religious figures in these paintings sexy. Yes. And that was never mm-hmm. done before. And he'll be immortalized for that in his short life.
You know, one time a man who wrote a biography of Caravaggio was on the radio, and he was talking about, you know, basically everything, not everything you said, but the bare bones fact of his life. And I called in and I said, do you think there's any possibility that Caravaggio used lenses in, you know, optical devices to do his paintings, because he was always on the run. He was never in one place very right. long. And he said, oh, a man like Caravaggio would never cheat like that.
Oh, no.
I thought that was great.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty
yeah,
great.
Think
yeah.
about
He's
that.
Cheating in other areas.
Right, but not that area. So I'm going to talk about Fred Sandbeck. Joseph Albers used to say that art inhabits the gap between the factual and the actual. In 1967, the American artist Fred Sandbeck, in his basement studio at Yale, made his first sculpture with wire and cord. He outlined the shape of a 12-foot-long 2x4 plank of wood resting on the floor. While his classmates were pounding, welding, and casting metals, he was clipping and bending thin wires and adhering bits of cord to them. He made a number of similar shapes that year, outlining cubes, planes, and other forms on the floor and against the wall. He was a burly, sit-to-outdoorsy guy who found his artistic voice, tracing delicate lines in the air. He worked with elastic cord and acrylic yarn to delineate or bifurcate three-dimensional space. He would create room-filling volumetric forms using the most minimal of means. He stretched single strands of yarn point to point to create geometric figures, precise and subtle delineations of pictorial planes and architectural volumes. Sandbeck was born in Bronxville, New York in 1943. His earliest exhibitions looked like someone had drawn in the air with a pencil the outlines of objects or furniture that might have filled an otherwise empty room. There was a plate of glass leaning against a wall, here a picture in the corner, and over there a neat row of boxes pushed against another wall. Except these things weren't actually there. All that existed were the lines that defined their perimeters. He expanded the sculptures, but only slightly. He would fasten the yarn diagonally, floor to ceiling, or wall to wall, and work with the entire volume of the room. He would run straight lines through the space and along the walls or floor, cutting the air with the most rudimentary of shapes. And here's what it looks like. Yep. You walk into a large room, a large gallery room, and there are strands of yarn stretching. They may be either black or green or red, and they're stretching from one point to another. And when you see the illusion, it's as though the strings are defining a pane of glass. And then the more you see many panes of glass, like that Marcel Marceau illusion of being behind a pane of glass that's
the
not
mime,
really there.
Yeah.
Yes. And you can walk through it, but you don't, because the illusion is real. It's the simplest idea, but then it gets more complicated. And when you walk around, the illusion changes. The experience of being in a gallery by works of Sandbeck always involves the striking sense of how little is actually there. It is the intensity of being in a room where there is next to nothing, and yet there's something. The strength of the sculpture is not about the shapes he forms. It's about the capability of a shape that is barely there to heighten the feeling that you are there. In the end, when the show comes down, the yarn is rolled up and thrown in the wastebasket, and all that's left are the plans and a few drawings. When he was in school, Sandbeck spent the summer in Paris drawing Michelangelo's slave sculptures every day. And when he began to draw with string and space, his teachers recognized something extraordinary in him and accepted Sandbeck into the graduate program, where he cultivated the artistic approach he would sustain his whole life. When he was 26 years old, he was called upon to defend his work, the Emperor's New Clothes argument, which was and still is the question about contemporary art. And instead of defending the righteousness of his calling, upholding the idea of the artist as a unique figure in society, as someone who provides new ways of seeing the world. Sandbach took the opposite tack. Instead of defending the integrity of contemporary art, he was open to the possibility that there might not be anything at all special. Sandbach did not make any pretenses as art. He said, if you want one of my sculptures, you can simply imitate it. All you need is a ball of string. And then the question, but then would I have a genuine Sandbach? And Sandbach said, are you claiming there's something special about my strings that other strings don't have? Sandbach was able to suggest something like, your suspicions may be valid. Maybe there is nothing at all unique about my string sculptures. But remember, you're the one who placed expectations on them. You're the one who elevated me by caring about a genuine Sandbach. For my part, I leave it as a question whether I myself are doing anything different than what anyone else can do. Though he made art to interest himself, he understood from the very beginning the price he had to pay, a huge financial sacrifice for making something so close to nothing. He knew that avoiding the heroics of making large, heavy things or finely wrought things required him to risk the concept that he was making nothing special. Sandbach filled a career with ever new ways of practicing, as he put it, the art of trying to stretch a line between two points. You can imagine the artist arriving in some forest place he showed frequently in Europe with just a few drawings and a ball of acrylic rope in his backpack. That's all he needed, really, to create a work on site or to adjust a piece to the space at his disposal and thus activate it. His entire life he struggled to counter the idea that art ever arrives at his final definition, but it is a thing, stable and self-contained. Even after they were purchased by museums and collectors, but because he knew he had a distinct sensitivity to what made the work feel vital and in space, for him, the feeling of vitality was the essence of art. It's what he admired in Michelangelo. He understood that being special is not an objective reality inherent in certain things or situations. It is a feeling or response to them. He wanted the specialness of his sculpture to be determined inside the room. He wanted it to be felt there, standing between two parallel pieces of yarn stretching from floor to ceiling. One never really knows why anyone commits suicide. But the near coincidence of the opening of Dia Beacon, where a vast space is dedicated to his work, and the tragic end of his life suggests that the reemerging specter of permanence did little, if anything, to lift his spirits. But he left us with something he created, something totally new.
Well, Fred Sandbach is an absolute marvel. I mean, I can't state it enough. He was a genius. And that art broke so many barriers about space, air, and energy. Oh, to experience, you have to experience
yes.
his art.
Yeah.
You're in a space and you experience it. This is something, you know,
right.
we can't really, you did a good job there, Sheila, over the air, but you have to see
you
it
have to
in
see
its
it because
space.
Because it's constantly unfolding.
Yeah,
you're in it and you see more and more.
I mean, and yet, when I see his work, there's a sadness that comes with it and the enigma of that man and that intelligent artist and his demise. I mean, he suffered with depression, his wife said, for many, many years. And we've, of course, forewarned you again that this is a very heavy show. And many of our listeners have commented how the show was somber but informative and yet sensitive to the artist's legacy. But we need to take a station break. We're going to have a little break here to get you guys to get ready for the second half of our intense material.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park 94.3 FM.
Well, throughout this program, we want to make sure our listeners know we're not making any judgments about a person's lifestyle or emotional and physical states. We feel that this is important to tell the story about these hosts of artists that have left a legacy that endures, even if they were only productive for a few years in expressing their visual art.
So now we need to talk about a great master in the history of art, Raphael Sanzio di Urbino. Tom, you do that so much better than I do.
Oh, sorry.
What can we say about one of the great masters of the Renaissance and one of the revered Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Raphael was from the town of Urbino in La Marche, a province east of Tuscany, and a very vibrant art community in history. He was born in 1483, at a time when Italy was percolating with talent in the Renaissance. In his early teenage years, his talent was obvious. He was from royalty and artistic lineage, as his father was a court painter. He had excellent training and was known to be under the Umbrian painter Pietro Perugino. His reputation as a young talent spread, and he worked everywhere in major art centers from Florence to Rome. He was hot to trot, and not just with the paints and brushes, but with the ladies also. He was lavish, boyish, handsome, and had a flair for taste and etiquette. Girlfriends and mistresses,
and a reputation
he was summoned to the Vatican, where his older rival Michelangelo was painting the walls and ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Raphael would do other rooms on the premises in his style and mastery of illusion. His work had a delicacy and refinement few had seen before him. His output in panel painting, fresco, portraits, drawing, architecture, and collaborations were tremendous in his short life. He was popular, respected, and very hardworking. His relationship to the church was favorable, and he had a great future. Like Masaccio, Raphael's death was mysterious, and his end of his life story is plagued by rumors of marriage, engagements, and consistent infidelities. Some references mention his sex binging, which led to his fever that ultimately killed him on Good Friday, April 6, 1520, at age 37. The circumstances were ugly, as it was reported that he was with his mistress and not possible future wife. Oh my God. No conclusive evidence was found or recorded of his death, which alone is mysterious. And he had was such a public figure in the church and in the visual arts. His legacy was so long, the British art movement, the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, took his name and his talent as their banner for critical painting in the 19th century. They hailed Raphael as their shining star.
Well, Raphael is a figure to be reckoned with in the history of art, but one of my favorite painters, and we're going to fast forward a few centuries, was the great French painter Edouard Manet, who lived another short life, like so many of the others we're talking about today. His demise was rapid and tragic, like his father's. They both died of syphilis at very early ages, and both were known to frequent brothels. The painter was dead at 51 years old. Manet was a great painter and truly one of my favorites, and he set the stage for French realism and in the Impressionist movement. And although he was not associated with the Impressionists, he was associated with some of the members and the social circles, and that they all hung out together, and that was something we don't have today, which I wish we did. Manet studied under the great teacher Thomas Couture, and he was a great painter himself. And he traveled extensively at a young age, and he saw much about art elsewhere. Manet, like his French counterpart Gustave Courbet, rebelled against the French academic traditions of style, subject, and palette. Some of his works reflected the politics of the time, social justice themes, which were not cool in the French aristocracy and monarchy, and the bohemian climate of his circle at the time. Manet was influenced by Spanish painting in some ways with his fluid and energetic brushstroke that also identified the later Impressionists. Manet used black oil paint extensively with power, which was actually frowned upon at the time. He painted fast and furiously and very intuitively. Well, in his mid-40s, he began to be suffered with these circulatory issues and paralysis of his lower extremities. And he used to go to these spas to seek treatment of relief of these arthritic and rheumatoid kind of, you know, diagnoses that were really crippling him. Well, these symptoms were really advanced stages of syphilis, and he had a foot amputated due to his lack of circulation, and gangrene set in. And he died at age 51 from the fever associated with the amputation. Remember, no antibiotics, and the syphilis at age. And he really was a master of groundbreaker for the French Impressionists.
Wow.
Great painter.
Yep. And I'm going to talk another sad story, Modigliani. Amadeo Clemente Modigliani is probably one of the most recognizable artists of the 20th century. His life is associated with poverty, abuses, and tragedy, made for a Hollywood movie, and it was with Andy Garcia starring as Modigliani.
And that was a tragedy.
Yes. He only lived until he was 35 years old, and yet he was a prolific and tireless worker amid his hard life. He was born in Livorno from a Sephardic Jewish family in Italy in 1884. He showed great skill and promise as an artist from a very young age, and his mother supported his desire to study art, and he traveled to Florence to see Italy's great artistic legacy. He was well trained in Italy before leaving. At 22, he moved to the center of the art world, Paris, and he crossed paths with the best of the best, like Brancusi and Pablo Picasso. He was the quintessential starving artist, and he looked the role and lived amid the art squalor of Montmartre. He was constantly in painter's clothes, much to the chagrin of his fellow cosmopolitan artist friends. It's true, because Manet used to wear like a very nice black coat, and
yes,
he was much the
he's
dandy.
Classy. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. No, no, yeah. He was not. He looked like he just got out of bed, yeah, and went to the party.
He had bouts of respiratory illnesses and finally tuberculosis, which was dulled by heavy drinking and drug use from various sources like hashish, absinthe, and opium derivatives. He was very public about his addictions, and his behavior was legendary among art circles. He contracted tubercular meningitis, and he died at 35. His funeral was attended by many great world-renowned artists in Paris at the time. His legacy in sculpture, painting, and drawing is great. He is a seminal player in Cubism, Dada, Surrealism, and Futurism. His iconic portraits and style make him one of the most recognizable artists of all time. The footnote, and most tragic, is that is associated with his name, is that the day after his death, his pregnant wife from their second child threw herself off a fifth floor balcony and died with their unborn child. Jean Herbertin, his wife with child, sealed the very tragic life of the great artist Amadeo Modigliani. It really does not get any sadder than this. Modigliani, its epitaph reads, "Struck down by death at the moment of glory." And his fiancée's reads, "Devoted companion to the extreme sacrifice." Wow.
Wow, that's intense. Yeah, that was quite well done in the movie, although the movie had some issues, but that last scene was pretty intense. Well, I'd like to talk about Elizabeth Siddal. Elizabeth Siddal, we talked about the Pre-Raphaelite group, and she was associated with that. Elizabeth Siddal is one of the most recognizable faces in artwork from the Pre-Raphaelite painters, and she was their most famous model and an artist herself. Her visage has been immortalized in many works by her colleagues like Ford Madox Brown, William Holman Hunt, John Everett Millais, and Edward Burne-Jones. These were very talented British painters. And she was born in 1829, and she died in 1862 at age 32. She was an influential artist and poet, too, and her husband was the great poet-painter Dante Gabriel Rossetti. And she was born in London, and there's no kind of records about whether she was educated or not, but Dante Gabriel Rossetti made sure she had training in poetry and in painting. But she was very fragile, and she was the model for the great Millais painting Ophelia from Hamlet, where she's lying dead in this lake, in this little, mm-hmm, swampy area, and she actually got very, very ill from modeling. She actually was, mm-hmm, sitting in a cold tub, uh-huh, and she got very sick. I mean, you talk about these freak accidents. She, yeah, got pneumonia for modeling for her colleague, yeah, John Millais, and she got very, very sick, and she really kind of, her whole life was this sickness of fragility, and her husband said, "No more modeling for you." Well, you know, they got married, and he kind of put her in, kind of segregated her from her friends, And she got very, very depressed and very, very frail. And she went to France. She was stressed. She was depressed. And there's rumors that she was also anorexic. And then tuberculosis set in. And she because of a tuberculosis, she became dependent on laudanum, which is an opiate derivative. And she became addicted. Well, she got pregnant. She lost a child. It gets so sad. And then she finally overdosed in 1862 from the opium derivative. And there was a very mysterious thing going on because there was a suicide note that was found. And the suicide note was found by Ford Madox Brown, the other artist who was a friend of her husband, Dante Gilbert Rossetti. But Ford Madox Brown told the husband, do not save the note, because if she cannot be buried in a Christian place as a Christian, because suicide was against the rules. So they burned the suicide note. And since it was illegal, immoral, and scandalous at the time to commit suicide, she was buried in, you know, Christian burial, but that's really not the story. The story got, you know, a little heavier. And her legacy really inspired many, many things in theater, music, and poetry. And she is really the face, literally, of the Pre-Raphaelite movement's paintings. And a beautiful woman at that.
Yes. Yeah, and she painted self-portraits also.
Yeah, very. She was a good painter.
Yeah.
Well, here we go,
okay,
Sheila.
Here
this
we
is
go.
Your moment.
Okay, here we go. Okay, I'm going to talk about a world-class charlatan, Thomas Kincaid. Okay, so here's what Thomas Kincaid said about his own work, and I'm going to quote, because he spoke of himself in the third person. In the often hurried and complex world we live in, the images that Thomas Kincaid painted offer a place of refuge, a place where the transient things of life give way to the things that matter most. He was, however, derided and dismissed by the art world. Kincaid's paintings have glowing highlights and pastel colors. They're bucolic settings such as gardens, streams, stone cottages, lighthouses, and main streets. He also depicted various Christian themes. Kincaid's production method was a semi-industrial process in which low-level apprentices embellish a prefab base provided by Kincaid. It is assumed that he had a hand in most of the original paintings, but it's only assumed. But he employed studio assistants to create multiple prints of his famous oils. The pieces collectors were likely to own were printed factory-like, and when a collector would buy a piece, Kincaid would appear, and with a flourish of his brush, he'd paint on the highlights.
Hmm.
Yeah, and then he would receive the money. His images,
a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money. His images were licensed to Hallmark and other corporations, and they appear extensively on merchandise, such as calendars, jigsaw puzzles, greeting cards, and CDs. His images also appeared on Walmart gift cards and on the QVC shopping network.
Oh, man, this guy was out there.
Opposite of what we consider high art. Kincaid said he gained his inspiration from his Christian beliefs. And he quotes, when I got saved, God became my art agent. He also said that his goal as an artist was to touch people of all faiths and to bring a sense of peace into their lives through the images he created. Many pictures contain specific chapter and verse allusions to Bible passages. Well, it seems like his artistic goals weren't enough to bring him a sense of peace. Some of Kincaid's former colleagues and employees and even collectors in sworn testimony said that he had a long history of cursing and heckling other artists and performers. He openly fondled women at a sales event. He had a habit he called ritual territory marking through urination. He once relieved himself on a Winnie the Pooh figure at the Disneyland Hotel in Anaheim while saying, "This one's for you, Walt. This is true."
Sheila,
I see you
really
laughing over there. It's
with,
true.
With the eight count here.
He made himself and his business associates tens of millions of dollars. But in the years before his death, his business and his life took a battering. There were allegations of malpractice, and his company declared bankruptcy following a series of court judgments, which ordered him to pay $860,000 for defrauding the owners of two failed franchises. More suits were pending. In 2012, the Painter of Light, which is a trademark, died from an overdose of diazepam and ethanol, and he was 54.
Wow. Well, I learned a lot with that one. Well, we have so much to say and so little time, but I'm going to talk about Jean-Michel Basquiat, who we already have talked about, who was one of the most intelligent and ambitious and gifted artists that rose from homelessness at age 15 in New York City to a powerhouse in the graffiti pop movement of the early 1980s. He was a part of a collaborative duo named Samo, and they were painting in New York City and Brooklyn, where he was born. His painting recently sold for $25,000 very early in his career, and in 2017, at a Sotheby auction, a 1982 work sold for $110 million. That is something else. I mean, it's incredible. When you read about this prolific nature of the artist that died at age 27, one wonders how it was possible to paint 600 paintings and 1,500 drawings in his lifetime. Sheila, that blows my mind.
That's my mind, too.
Anyway, then I think about some kind of burnout. Anyway, we're going to have to cut this a little short, but he was discovered by Andy Warhol, and there's also a great movie about him. And yet, with all that, you know, hoopla of the art scene in those days, his work really kind of left a legacy about colonialism, class struggle, and politics as a young black painter coming from a black Latino background. And his work was so powerful. I have to admit, when I first saw his, he did those skull paintings. They're very, very powerful, very graffiti-like. And he was on every major venue to show his work in the short period of his life. While there was a downside to his fame and recognition, his tremendous work ethic and stress mixed with an incredible need for heroin in his life. Many in his circle were knowledgeable and vocal about this growing problem in his life, but it was kind of like a runaway train, and many people tried to help him, and he sought rehab, but unfortunately, the hopes of his heroin addiction ended with an overdose in 1988. Mm.
Well, some artists do not have good DNA, and there are hosts of terrific artists that have died young due to diseases like cancer and other illnesses and health episodes.
Well, there's so many artists that we could talk about here, but we're going to just close the show with the great American painter Grant Wood. And the reason I'm closing the show is he's the iconic painter of the famous American Gothic. We know the woman and the man standing there, the man with the pitchfork behind this middle America house. And the reason we're going to end the show with it, it's a painting that most everyone knows, and everyone's seen it on mugs, t-shirts, so on and so forth. And Grant Wood was a very enigmatic painter, and he also died young at the age of 50 from pancreatic cancer. And although that painting, you know, vaulted him to fame, much of his legacy was a little more complicated than one thinks. He was trained well at the Art Institute of Chicago, but there was a moment when his father died, and it really scarred him when he was only 9. And he was very influential in the regionalist movements of Thomas Hart Benton and John Stuart Curry. And he was really powerhouse during the Depression and the agricultural life and farming of that middle America. Well, he was also a good printmaker, a muralist, a stained glass designer, and he was taught at the University of Iowa. But unfortunately, he had a very, very secretive life, and he basically got married. It was very, very much, but he was very closeted as a homosexual man, and it basically was very stressful for him living in middle America with that, and he died at age 50 from pancreatic cancer. Sheila, we're going to have to end the show. Why don't you close with that legacy?
Well, being an artist is what gives my life meaning. I can look at the work I did 50 years ago and feel some pride, and friends that I have who are still artists feel the same. And that after all this time, I think we agree we've had privileged lives. I do have times of despair, but just indulge it for a day or two, because what else can I do? And then there's always what I'm working on, to see it through. I'm the worst homebody. Going on vacation is not something I relish. And you too, Tom.
Yeah, me too.
I think that the fact that I'm an artist is respected, though my work isn't much understood, despite my efforts to make it absolutely clear. This radio show for me is an attempt to communicate, to not feel so isolated.
Thank you for that, Sheila. And yes, art defines culture and humanity and creativity. And this show is also about the legacy and the experience that these young artists gave us. Sheila, I want to thank Peter and Bobby for doing such a great job in my absence. Stay tuned to Bobby Hill's This Music. Bobby shares an incredible knowledge of musical depth with the show coming up right after ours at 10. And Bobby on Wednesday again for Borderlines. Between 10 and noon, no border, no lines, with great musical variety. Thanks again. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Have a great day, everyone.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Good time.